This is episode 743 of the AWS podcast, released on October 27th, 2025.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the AWS podcast. Simon Leach here with you. Great to have you back, joined by two very special guests. And this is a special episode, one of our Frugal Architect episodes, which I know a lot of you really hang out for. And of course, you can't have a Frugal Architect episode without our VP and CTO of Amazon.com, Werner Vogels. G'day, Werner. How are you doing?
Hi, Simon. Yeah, I'm doing well. We'll be having a good time here.
It's good to have you back to talk about the very important topic of frugality. And to help us with that is an amazing customer guest. We're going to be speaking with Boyan Slat. Boyan founded the Ocean Cleanup at age 18 with just 200 to 300 euros of saved pocket money after encountering more plastic bags and fish while diving in Greece at the age of 16. That's confronting. What started as a viral TEDx talk in 2013 has grown into a global operation that's removed over 70.5 million pounds of trash from aquatic ecosystems worldwide. His approach to engineering is defined by constraints-driven thinking, so he's in the right place, starting with limitations rather than capabilities, iterating relentlessly, and letting mission guide technical decisions. Under his leadership, the Ocean Cleanup has developed systems from passive ocean collectors to AI-powered river interceptors operating across 20 rivers in 9 countries while targeting 1,000 rivers by 2040. Boyan, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
That's a hell of a journey.
Yeah, and actually, I wanted to say, I think we're at about 91 million pounds of trash collected now.
Well, so I was going to say, but who's counting? Yeah. But clearly, it's important to count.
That's right.
Well, you know, you were quite young when you started this, 18, at Delft, yep. I assume. You were still there. So tell us a bit about the story. What drove you to get this going at all?
Sure, yeah. Look, I think I've always been a bit of an inventor all my life. I've been very passionate about building things, about engineering. Going all the way back to when I was sort of 2-3 years old, I remember building my own chair out of sort of wood and nails, just because I thought that'd be more fun to sit on than one my parents would give me. And then it sort of went into my next passion was sort of computers, so sort of assembled my own tower, and then was into chemistry and I was building sort of explosives and smoke bombs, and one day almost burned down the house because I was distilling ammonium nitrate on the stove. I kind of lost track of time.
As you do.
And, the entire house was in smoke, which was my mom really loved that phase. and then I was into to model rockets. And then when I was 12, 13, I decided to set a Guinness World Record, launching more than 200 of them at the same time. So, really, I've never been bored is the short summary of it. But it all wasn't very useful. It's just sort of having an idea and then making that real. I think there's just an immense amount of satisfaction I get out of that. But then, when I was 16, I went scuba diving in Greece, and I was hoping to see beautiful nature. I went underwater, and I came across more plastic bags than fish. And sort of the natural thing for my brain to ask myself was, well, why can't we just clean this up? And once an idea like that or a question like that start brewing in my head, I really cannot stop thinking about it. So. And then I went to Delft to study aerospace engineering. At the same time, I still was obsessed with this idea. And then after half a year, there's this point when I said, like, well, I can't really do both, so let's give this a try. If it doesn't work out, I can always re-enroll after half a year. But then, a few months later, there was this TEDx presentation I had given that went viral, was shared millions of times, and then that allowed me to build an initial team, raised the first few million dollars, and got us going. So,
So it's talking about funding there. originally crowdfunding. But so how did you get from crowdfunding to having a, let's say, a sustainable income for your business such that you can continue to run it?
Of course, what the challenge, what we're trying to solve is essentially, you know, we're creating a tremendous amount of value. So when you look at the harm done to ecosystem services by plastic, it's estimated to be between 500 billion and 2.5 trillion a year. So, and there are not many companies with sort of that level, if any, at that level of sort of revenue. But of course, most of that value is not value that's captured in the GDP of human civilization, right? It's things like clean air, coastal protection, being able to go to a coast and having clean beaches, you know, having marine life, all of that. So, of course, we tap part of that through tourism, fisheries, etc. But a lot of it is not captured. So I think if something can be a for-profit, it should be a for-profit, because then you know, there's such a beauty in having this alignment of incentives between your team members, shareholders, wider society. But the problem is, of course, when you're doing something like this, which is really outside of the market, you don't have that. So that's why I opted to start a nonprofit when I started this. I really didn't see any other way to get it off the ground. And you know, crowdfunding, actually the first crowdfunding campaign was $89,000. And then the second one a year later was $2 million. That got us started, but of course wasn't of the scale that was required to really make this work. But thankfully over time, I think the way we've approached this is almost like investment round. So basically we raise some money, and then we get results, and then with those results, we get to the next level of credibility. And yeah, I think, you know, your level of credibility has to be sort of proportional to the amount of money you can raise, or it naturally becomes that, right? So,
but you're also building things. So for that, you absolutely need capital to be able to do that.
Yeah, exactly. So I think then over time, we were fortunate enough that both individuals and companies stepped up to support us. So you got people like, Mark Benioff, Salesforce, Joe Gebbia, Airbnb, as well as, you know, literally millions of other people who decided, like, hey, I want to be part of this. This is like an Apollo project for the Earth. This is really exciting, and we want this to happen. And then over time, of course, at the beginning, it was this very high-risk, high-reward project. But over time, as risk came down, and now it's, at this moment, it's not a question anymore whether we can do it. We know exactly what to do. It's really just a scaling challenge. Companies also started to get involved. And there, of course, it's more than philanthropy. It's really an exchange of value, right? Because for corporates, partnering with us, it allows them to have this variable story, increases brand value, increases awareness. So these partnerships is something I'm really excited about. And the journey is a business type of transaction.
Recently, I heard a lot about microplastics. Yeah, that are inside people and inside fish and things like that. Is there a relationship between what you are trying to clean up and those microplastics?
For sure, yeah. The fortunate thing is that only a very small fraction of plastic in the ocean is currently microplastics. It's in the order of a few percent. Most of the plastic is actually large stuff. And of course, what we do is, you know, unfortunately, the tiniest pieces, they're really too small to extract. Fortunately, over time, they will, you know, wash up on shorelines, so they won't be there forever. But of course, by removing everything that's not microplastic, all the larger objects, you prevent the creation of those microplastics, because they are really coming from the degradation of larger plastics. And then on top of that, by what we do in rivers, we prevent the inflow of new plastic into the ocean. I think what we do is we really prevent this ticking time bomb of the amount of microplastic increasing tenfold, hundredfold in the next few decades if we don't clean this up.
So boy, let me take you back to the early days, and your first system called Wilson, which I understand didn't last too long before it sort of reached its limit. Tell us about that and what that really, how that changed your thinking.
So the original vision to clean up the Great Pacific Garbage Patch was to have a giant U-shaped barrier that was passive, that was just free-floating. It would be pushed forth by wind and waves and would corral the plastic inside of it, so we'd only have to come by periodically and empty it out and bring it to the plastic to land for recycling, which was a very elegant idea on paper. But in reality, it turned out it didn't collect plastic, so we took it out, and then we deployed it, and then it didn't collect plastic. And really just a few months later, it broke into two. And obviously, we learned a tremendous amount from that. And after that, we kind of completely changed the approach. And then we eventually got to a system that worked. But looking back, I think what I would have done differently is that obviously we learned a lot, but I think we could have learned the same lessons in a cheaper way. We were so we truly believed that was the system that was going to clean our ocean. It was always like this
tunnel vision sort of thing.
And then ultimately, I mean, you're going to fail along the way, right? When you're doing something new, you're going to have so many failures. But I think, you know, your job as an innovator is really to make sure that you can recover from those failures and that you make mistakes in an as cheap and fast way as possible. It was great what we learned, but I think we could have learned it with a system that was maybe a tenth of the scale and maybe close to shore rather than actually in the middle of the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. So that's kind of the thing I would have done differently.
So you started off with trying to attack the biggest problem there was.
Yeah, right. So it wasn't really this MVP approach, I would say. Before that, we had done scale model tests and we had done prototypes near shore, but the actual thing of catching the plastic, which is, again, quite an important requirement for an ocean cleanup system, we only really put that to the tests at full scale in the real environment. While, you know, maybe we could have done that with simulated plastic or something closer to shore.
So these are lessons. There's a famous T-shirt I'm sure you've all seen that says, "I don't often test, but when I do, it's in production." And that's sort of the experience there.
Yeah, and I think when we started out, we really didn't. I think we went through 6 or 7 conceptual iterations over the years, and it was really like the way I imagine it is like a landscape full of hills, and your goal is to climb get on top of the highest the tallest hill, and then there's this dense fog and you can only look 3 to 5 meters ahead of you, and at some point you're climbing a hill, but you don't know yet whether it's actually going to be the right hill, the one that you actually want to end up on. So it does take a certain degree of trial and error to find that hill. But again, it's really just about trying to limit the cost of that experimentation.
And absolutely,
I guess it's always very hard to know, like, am I climbing the right hilltop here? I think one thing that I noticed is when you're actually climbing the right hill, things seem to get simpler and simpler over time, while when you're climbing the wrong hill, actually things get spiral into complexity. So I remember when we were still trying to make that passive system work, there was this challenge of, you have these contradicting design requirements, where on one hand you want the system to be flexible, to be able to follow the waves so that it doesn't break under sort of fatigue loads. But on the other hand, you also want to keep the system open because you don't want this U to collapse, because otherwise there's plastic can't enter, right? So then at some point in time, we got to the point that we were doing engineering studies on a literally an Eiffel Tower-sized steel structure that was submerged below the water level that would act like a spreader to keep that U open. And then at some point I was thinking, like, guys, what are we doing here? This is insane. We're creating a literal Eiffel Tower here, like a steel truss structure. And it's kind of this... you might be familiar with this idea of epicycles, you know, before Copernicus figured out that everything was rotating around the sun. There were these other models that kind of mathematically you could make work, but basically you got these little circles on circles, and it just was not simple at all. But you could make it work. But I think that when you see epicycle, it's kind of a hint that, okay, I'm not on the right track here. I'm climbing the wrong hill.
So in a lot of the early systems in the sort of starting off point, you were using a lot of sort of off-the-shelf hardware and open source models for computer vision, et cetera. And things have changed a lot since then. But what did those experiences teach you that you still apply today?
Yeah, so computer vision is general to sensing is really a core part of our solutions. If you think about it, the key to our success is being there where the plastic is. That applies to both what we do in the Great Pacific Garbage Patch in the middle of the ocean, as well as in rivers, where in this Great Pacific Garbage Patch, you got an area three times the size of France, where on average the plastic is super dispersed. But then you got, when you take a sailboat through it, there are days when you see hardly any plastic, and there's days when you see tons and tons of plastic around you. So being able to determine where these hotspots are, which, by the way, are dynamic, they have come and go all the time in different places, different times, that is really the key, because otherwise you're just basically sieving the ocean. It's really about pinpointing, you know, those places where the plastic is. And similarly in rivers, what we found is that less than 1% of the world's rivers is responsible for 80% of plastic pollution. So being in the right, in the correct rivers is sort of the key to being able to do this effectively. So what that means is, really, when we go into these coastal cities, it's deploying hundreds of sensors around the city, being able to determine which are the, you know, what's the Pareto here, which rivers do most of those emissions, and where in those rivers should we deploy. And for example, some rivers, you got vessel traffic as well, right? So you can't block off the entire river with our systems. So there we release GPS trackers that mimic the flow of plastic, so we can really, again, strategically deployed there where the plastic goes, while giving enough space for boats to pass. So it's all about being at the right place at the right time. And even though the cleanup system, the hardware, is simple, and it must be simple because complex hardware is very hard to scale. It breaks down. It's hard to maintain. It's hard to deploy, etc. So you want to keep the hardware as simple as possible, and then basically all the complexity, that's really applied to more the what we call the software side, right? So really the intelligence of, especially upfront in terms of determining where you you deploy.
So why is it actually that these 20 rivers are the ones that are causing most pollution? I mean, is that because, is it humans? Is it factories? Is it, I mean, how come there's only these 20 rivers that actually take 80% of plastic?
Yeah, well, so we are currently deployed in 20 rivers, but the 1% actually represents in the order of 1,000 rivers. So it's still a significant amount. But I guess when we say rivers, a more accurate word would be waterways. Most of them are pretty small drains. What we see is that these rivers are concentrated in coastal cities in middle-income countries, where you got a combination of a high concentration of population close to the coast, And you have basically very poor waste management infrastructure. These are countries that are rapidly developing economically. People now have enough wealth to buy a lot of stuff wrapped in plastic, but the government basically does not have the money yet to do proper waste collection and disposal. What's quite interesting is that there's really no correlation between the amount of plastic that a country consumes and the amount of plastic that it emits to the ocean. Essentially, there's this thing called a Kuznets curve, which is like an inverted U, where the poorest country, they hardly emit any plastic because they don't consume any plastic. The richest countries, they consume most of the plastic. So the world's richest countries, they consume about a third of all the plastic, but they're responsible for less than 0.5% of global plastic emissions because, you know, here in Western Europe and US and Japan, Korea, we of course have good systems to collect the waste and dispose of it. It's really this middle ground, places like Jakarta, Manila, Mumbai, Accra, places like that where you have a lot of people, a lot of plastic now getting consumed, but basically no way to collect and dispose of it.
Yeah, I was very fortunate a few weeks ago in the Amazon.
Oh, yeah.
And no plastic, yes, in the Amazon.
I think what's quite interesting as well is that most plastic that ends up in rivers never makes it to the ocean. So whatever plastic gets, we actually tested this with a GPS tracker experiment. So a year ago, we released, I think, about 100 GPS trackers in Manaus, in the Amazon. None of them made it to the ocean. and that's really because it's so far inland. And of course, the slope of the river is also, it's very shallow, right? It's like an ocean almost. It's not like a very aggressive, fast-flowing river. You know, that plastic just gets sort of beached on the riverbanks and gets stuck in twigs. But that stuff, yeah, doesn't make it to the ocean. So that's, of course, also, you know, when we started out back in 2017, our first global river model actually predicted that the Amazon would be a key contributor. But back then we didn't really understand the physics yet. We didn't know this fact. And now when we take that into account, actually, the Amazon just completely drops off our list of priority, which is good because it's an insanely big river. And I'm very glad we got to do that one.
So Boyan, tell us a bit more about something the team did using some artificial intelligence where you cut data transmission costs by 99.975%. That's a lot of cuttage. Can you walk us through how you used AI as a practical tool rather than a silver bullet?
We developed something we call ADIS. It's the Automatic Debris Identification System, which are these cameras that we attach to ships, just merchant vessels like cargo ships, container ships, that go around the world all the time. And whenever they end up, whenever they enter port, they send a data package to headquarters here, and it actually tells us the concentration of plastic along the path in the ocean that they traveled. And we use this to better determine the location of the plastic in the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, but also as a global thermometer for how we're doing, right? Because ultimately, we make it very explicit, we want to help ourselves out of business. But for that, we need to know when we're done, and we really need to be able to track what is the trend in terms of how much plastic is in the ocean. So by having these ships continuously traversing the ocean, getting that data, we are able to to have this global plastic thermometer. And
so these models run on the cameras itself.
Yeah.
So all the processing is done locally at the edge, and you basically get the data, the resulting data from that back.
Amazing. So that's such an impressive way of doing things. Now, one thing you touched on here is the global nature of the work you're doing, which introduces a whole lot of extra complexity. I mean, we talked about 20 rivers, 9 countries, you've got ships going everywhere. Like, there's a lot of stuff going on. How do you design your systems so that you don't need a specialist engineer everywhere? Because I could imagine that could get quite expensive if you went down that track.
Yeah, so I guess that's another one of those items for the list of mistakes I made, which is the original system that we developed to intercept plastic in rivers was a really cool machine. It was fully solar powered, fully autonomous, and like a trash eating robot essentially. And then we deployed them in places like Thailand, Indonesia, and then you discover, oh well, actually, first of all, it's very hard to import those things because how do you classify it? Is it a boat? Is it a barge? Is it a, what is it? There's no sort of line item.
There's no tick box for trash eating robot.
Yeah, so that's and then you need the permits to deploy. Again, same problem. Then installing it requires specialized installation vessels and equipment. It's quite difficult. Then you need to train people to operate it. Pretty difficult. You need people to, you need to have the maintenance, and then, you have these PLCs on board, and then like a tiny thing breaks, and you have to air freight something from Germany to fix it, and it's just a big mess, right? So, so then we got to the conclusion that okay, maybe people are underrated, and actually creating jobs in these places is actually also something that is sort of a positive side effect to what we do. So then we kind of backtracked on that and went to more simpler hardware, simpler ways, using excavators for extraction rather than conveyor belts, and that's working quite well. Of course, now the key is the technology is quite simple, but now we still, looking ahead right now, we're doing about one deployment per quarter. Next year, we want to get to a point where we're deploying one interceptor per week, roughly. So that scaling ramp, it really requires us to rethink the way we're doing things. It's still too much reinventing the wheel every time, seeing everything as a unique project. So it's all about building this project factory now where we standardize everything from the contracts we set up with the operators to all the individual hardware components to the installation manuals. It all has to be standardized because otherwise we will not be able to get to that deployment cadence.
You're generating or collecting an enormous amount of data. With all these ships and also the things that you have yourself. What do you do with the data? I mean, beyond just running your company and beyond making decisions yourself, is there something that you share with others as well?
Yeah, for sure. So we're just going through a review of some of the next cities we're going to tackle with our interceptors this morning. And it's amazing, for basically an entire city, we mapped the entire river network. We know exactly where all the landfills are. We know exactly where we need to deploy the trash flux out of each of the waterways. It's amazing. And then, of course, even post-deployment, we are collecting tons of data because we're able to see, what's the trash we're collecting, the composition, the quantity. And of course, we're using all this data to deploy the best possible solutions and to further optimize their efficacy and improve the next set of deployments. We're also using it to, of course, convince funders, partners to show we know what we're doing and we have a good plan to tackle a given city. But we're also sharing it with the local government because they are actually able to make better decisions with that data. For example, in Jamaica, one of the things we found is that the bulk of the trash was styrofoam packaging. We shared that data with the government, and then they themselves decided to ban those styrofoam clamshell takeout packages in Jamaica, just because they saw, like, okay, actually the majority of trash coming down the rivers I guess a broader point there is that what we're doing, of course, is not the ultimate solution. Ultimately, we don't want plastic to even flow down these rivers. We hope one day those interceptors are not necessary anymore. But that's not going to happen tomorrow. But it's not either or, right? What we're doing, you know, through the data we collect, through the visibility we generate for the problem, we're actually able to help catalyze that upstream change as well.
So do you think you'll ever be done?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So, and I think there's two levels of done. I think there is the point when the oceans are clean, which I think is we should be able to express in years, not decades. So right now we're stopping between 2-5% of global plastic pollution. We've doubled last year. We're doubling again this year. So just mathematically, you don't need that many more doublings to
correct,
get to 100%. So yeah, and I think with with this 30 cities program, we want to tackle a third of emissions in the next few years. So that should allow us to maintain this annual 100% year-over-year growth. So I think pretty quickly we'll be able to get to the point that, hey, great, oceans are clean again. At that point, however, those interceptors are still necessary, right? And because if you stop operating them, you know, the oceans will get polluted again.
So stuff happens again.
Yeah. So, and I think that will be true for a while. I think before the entire developing world is as pristine as Singapore or something, I think will take a few decades. And of course, we need to make sure that the interceptors will keep operating during that time. Of course, what we do envision is that after a few years, the government can really step up in essentially integrating our interceptors into their waste management infrastructure. So it's basically just like they have garbage trucks in the streets, they need to operate interceptors in their rivers.
Interceptors, yeah.
But I think clean oceans very soon, but then the day that we can take out all the interceptors and we're, you know, it's truly done, I think that will be, you know, sort of decades away.
Now you spoke about the growth rate and sort of, you know, how much we need to double, et cetera. And obviously you want to maintain cost control to make sure you can grow in terms of the collection. And you've often said that cost per kilogram of plastic removed is one of the KPIs you really most value. Tell us about how you apply that metric to your technical decision-making.
Yeah, of course, the unit economics are very important. So we use this to really prioritize where we deploy. And it's also a metric that we use to drive continuous improvement, both in terms of initial investment, operational cost. It's something we use to judge the performance of our operator, so the, you know, the local contracted company that actually runs the interceptors. It's definitely a key metric. It's not the only metric. And I think one nuance that we're now recently started making is that it's really not cost per kilo of plastic, but it's really cost per unit of impact. Because, you know, in some places you can imagine, say, two hypothetical cities, one city that emits 1,000 tons a year, but where it's basically just sort of mud flats around the city. And then there's another city that maybe emits just 100 tons a year, but those 100 tons go straight into a coral reef with a tourism hotspot, where, of course, so the social environmental damage would be much greater than in the first scenario. So we're now able to actually put a dollar value to the ecosystems around those cities where the plastic goes. So we're able to better, again, make better decisions in terms of where we should prioritize our deployments.
That's amazing. Where does the plastic go? Like, you're collecting this plastic. What happens to it all?
The places where we go to tend to be the places where, of course, where the biggest leakage occurs, and where the greatest leakage occurs tends to be the places where the porous waste management infrastructure exists, right? So it is always quite a puzzle to figure out, okay, what do we do with this waste? And in most cases, we are able to find suitable, responsible destinations for this waste. So this can be, of course, there's this hierarchy of waste destinations. So ideally, what's at the top is recycling. So if in some places there's quite a large PET fraction, which is the type of plastic that's most valuable, easiest to recycle. So there, you have a big chunk that gets recycled. Then below that, you essentially got landfill and incineration, where, of course, we audit those destinations to make sure that those landfills don't leak, that the employment conditions are responsible, to really make sure that waste never ends up back in the environment and is staying there in a responsible way. As sometimes we actually have to decide, okay, there's no good solution here yet. However, we can't, there's just so much pollution, we just have to go deploy. And then we actually ourselves invest in improvements of the infrastructure to make sure that ultimately we can guarantee that none of our waste ever goes back in the environment. So that could be investing in sorting centers. It can be investing in something as simple as fencing around a landfill to make sure that the landfill doesn't leak into a river that's next to it. We believe it's our responsibility to make sure that everything we collect never ends up back in the ocean. So that's the story for the riverways, which is actually the more complicated story than for what we take out of the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, because there actually we're able to recycle almost everything. And we've made together with our partner Kia, we've made components of their electric cars out of our plastic. Coldplay's latest record has a special edition made of our plastic. With more and more partners coming on board, we're doing kind of fun and exciting things together with them to really tell the story of the ocean cleanup.
So, Boyan, one last question. Could be an easy one, could be a hard one. What's the most important thing that you've learned or something you've changed your mind about since you started the ocean cleanup?
Don't do it.
Actually, I keep a list of things I changed my mind about in my phone. So let me pull that up.
There's a tip right there, a podcast listener tip. Keep a list of things you change your mind about. Because one of the important things is to be flexible enough to change your mind, you know? What was it? When the facts change, I change my mind. What do you do?
I've recently heard Jeff Bezos say the same thing at a conference, where it's like you have to be very stubborn about the goal, but you have to be very flexible in terms of how you get there, right? And
stubborn on the vision, flexible on the details.
Well, Chris, I mean, the way that you solve this is you have a lot of hardware, and making hardware is always way more difficult.
Yep.
Than making software.
It's it's a long iteration cycle. So I think throughout my life, I think the connecting thread has been that I get an immense amount of satisfaction from having an idea, having a vision, and then seeing that become reality. And I think in the first few years, that mental image that was super crisp and sharp, and I could see that like a movie, that picture in my head, was always about seeing that first cleanup system in action, or seeing that first river system in action. And of course, I was able to make those pictures a reality together, of course, with the team and everyone that all that part is, etc. But actually, the lesson there has been that it was the wrong picture that I had in my head. I shouldn't have dreamt about this particular machine. I should have dreamt about a clean ocean, essentially, And yeah, I think as an inventor, it's very easy to get sort of an emotional attachment to your ideas, to your, you know, to your inventions, and that can stand in the way of being flexible enough when it comes to how you get to the goal. Because the goal is not having 1,000 interceptors on Earth. The goal is to have a clean ocean, and that's a subtle difference. Because of course we need one to get to the other, but it matters a tremendous deal.
Amazing, Boyan. Thanks so much for coming on and telling us about the journey.
Yeah, thank you. It's great. Great story. Great company. You guys doing amazing work.
Thanks so much.
Absolutely. And Werner, thanks for co-piloting again as we roll through hearing some of these great stories. I mean, it just shows that frugality affects the world in which we live in if applied properly. And of course, we do love to get your feedback. AWS podcast at amazon.com is the place to do it. And until next time, keep on building.